everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's April 2025, and you're listening to episode 443, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the video game Assassin's Creed Shadows. Today's guest is Cole Burgett, who is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. He teaches systematic theology and Bible exposition classes and writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written a video game review for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called Blades, Spirits, and the Sacred, Encountering Shintoism in Assassin's Creed Shadows. You can read this review for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Cole, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
So today we're talking, as I noted, about a video game called Assassin's Creed. But before we do, I just want to back up a lot because probably most of the listeners on this podcast, I would probably guess, don't play video games as primarily as a form of entertainment, so might have some questions about it. And we will link in the show notes some of the other articles we've done on video games, especially, you know, is it morally wrong to play them? But why are video games so popular? I mean, it seems like video games have eclipsed, you know, old school television or going to the movies. No one's actually in the theaters that much these days. And not just why are they so popular, but do a lot of Christians actually play video games?
Yeah. Video games have become one of the most popular forms of entertainment today. And they, in some respects, rival and often, I guess, surpass movies and television in terms of revenue and just cultural cash. I think there are a few factors that contribute to what has made them so popular. The first and sort of the most obvious is probably the interactivity of the medium. Unlike passive media, right? Movies, television, those are passive, engaging experiences. You just sort of sit and watch, as it were. In some ways, movies and television are, one could say, even less engaging than books. They're more passive than books or something like that. But video games sits at the opposite end of the spectrum. Video games engage the player actively. It's not just a sit and watch. You're also doing things with your hands, as it were, your fingers, I guess. And it offers, however small, a sense of agency and a sense of immersion. There's also the community that has sort of arisen surrounding video games, where because of video games, online multiplayer games create social networks and communities, especially among younger generations. You know, I growing up, I never played too many online games. I actually have the distinct memory. I was sitting on a plane once going to Europe and was seated next to a girl and had a conversation with her. And she told me that she was part of a World of Warcraft online. It was an online gaming group, World of Warcraft. And that she was traveling to Europe to meet with her crew, clan, whatever, little group.
They have like adventuring parties.
Yeah, exactly. And she was flying over there to meet with them. And I remember thinking, I would never do something like that. Fast forward, 15 years. I have my own little social network that arose from a video game, very much by happenstance. And one of the guys in the group who is my age was going through a pretty gnarly divorce. And I said, you know, you should probably just get away for a little bit of time. So he came out and slept on my couch for a week.
Like, it turned out to be an axe murderer or something. I think
Yeah, exactly. Had never met the guy in person. But we had gamed together for almost 2 years at that point, and had gotten to know each other pretty well. And it was a very strange thing to be standing in the airport going, I really hope this guy doesn't snap and murder me. But no, he turned out to be pretty good, and we still talk today. He's in the military, and is out of the country right now. So the community, the social network that comes out of video games is also, I think, a major selling point for why people invest in this stuff that no one talks about. There's also just very quickly the narrative, you know, many modern games, and this always sort of shocks people that I talk to who don't know much about video games, that video games are actually capable of telling very complex and I guess what you'd call cinematic stories. It's always sort of jarring to people. The show that I think we talked about on this podcast that is very popular is The Last of Us. Well, that began life as a video game, and the show itself is almost a perfect one-to-one adaptation. It's a little more fleshed out, obviously, for the medium, but the actual narrative and all of that stuff is the video game. And so it's kind of, you know, jarring that, you know, what started us, in many minds, what started as Pac-Man has got to that point where you're telling these sort of long dramas, if you will. But there are many video games today that have these very complex narratives. And then there, of course, there's the advances in technology, advancement of graphics, artificial intelligence, storytelling techniques. And, you know, there's probably a sense in which more people play video games than we realize. Even people we wouldn't think of gamers, like my mother, loves things like Candy Crush, mobile games, cloud gaming, affordable consoles. More people can access video games than ever before. So even if you're not necessarily sitting there crunching buttons, but you have a little game on your phone, you're still playing a video game. So it's very popular today. And as for Christians, yes, there are millions of Christians who play video games. And there is a pull there. I teach in one of my jobs. I teach in a Christian private school. And that is one of the easiest and most accessible ways to quote unquote connect with kids is video games. And you know, they know that I write about different video games and things like that, and that to them is like the coolest thing ever. And they, in their minds, I have the dream job. I get to write about video games and get paid for it. And they they've yet to figure out you got to do that a lot, and it takes time and all that kind of stuff. But it's one of the easiest ways to connect with those Christian kids is video games, because they enjoy it as recreation, art, obviously the social community and that sort of thing. So yeah, video games are very, very popular today.
Well, just so our listeners get some idea of maybe some older stats, there's 3 billion people that play video games. And you're right, from old school, I guess, was it 80s, where people went to the arcade and there are these huge machines, to now people playing video games on a device that fits into their pocket, not to mention, just like you said, online community where people are playing people from all over the world or joining up with people in teams if they play a certain kind of adventuring type of game, that is a thing. I think it's been a lot of innovation quite quickly even if you think about decades going from that to what we do now, is quite a lot. Now, do Christians, I mean, I think most people would say most non-Christians, but when 3 billion people worldwide are playing them, I'm assuming Christians are playing them. And, you know, I guess maybe some parents of yore thought that there was something inherently, you know, unbiblical about playing a video game.
Yeah, you've always had these sort of debates that have cropped up around video games. A great example of that would be the correlation between like violence and playing video games and that sort of thing. And what's interesting about just to use that particular discussion as sort of a lightning rod for this, I have for goodness, almost 20 years now, seen stats go all over the place with something like that. I have seen everything from there is absolutely zero correlation whatsoever to there's all the correlation in the world. And no one can sort of seem to agree on that kind of thing. And where I have always sort of landed the plane with this is that as with any type of film or television series or any type of book or any kind of media that someone consumes recreationally, whatever, there has to be discernment and intentionality, being thoughtful about what you play, what you watch, what you read, and why. If you have a kid who plays only and exclusively, let's say, crime-based video games, I would say that's probably as not smart as someone who only and ever listens to a certain kind of music genre. It's sort of just, there's an inherent and obvious, at least to me, logic to that, that is not good. And, you know, growing up, the games that always sort of took the flack for this were either Call of Duty or Grand Theft Auto.
Grand Theft Auto, people had a lot of issues with the content of it, especially because supposedly it was made for older kids, but it inevitably was junior high guys playing these kind of games.
Well, it's the same way at the school that I work at. I remember when I was younger, the GTA games having this kind of mystique about them, and played them as I got older, and really just sort of lost interest in the same way that I sort of lose interest in certain television series, because I don't find the stories all that compelling. I sort of get exasperated with watching bad people be bad. It sort of loses it's a kind of luster to me. And I often find two things. I often find on one hand, even though those are the games that are most talked about in media, those are not actually the games that kids play by and large the most. The kids at the school will talk about GTA, but at any given point in time, they're playing two or three or four different games, generally that they like more than that. And they have sort of less and less interest in that, as at least as I've known them. And I think part of that is attributed to the fact that Grand Theft Auto at the time was sort of the only kid on the block when it comes to the specific genre of game that it was doing. And now there are so many like it that don't sort of enmesh you in the world of criminals in the same way that that game does. And personally, I've just never cared all that much about those particular games. So on one hand, I would say that parental concerns of video games are justified in the same way that parental concerns for movies are justified, in the same way that parental concerns for the television shows your kids watch is justified. That's all justified. The key, as I said, is discernment and intentionality. It is not that these video games are marketed toward middle schoolers. There is a very clear rating on all of those adult-oriented games. That rating is mature. What I have never quite been able to wrap my head around is the gullible parent who doesn't pay attention to that, buys the video game and gives it to their kid, and is then shocked to see that it has certain content in it. When it's not like, you know, the even the cover art is subtle about what the game includes. So, you know, there are some very simple and common sense practices to employ, in the same way that if you see a film rated R and your kid says, "Can I go see this movie?" At the least, if you're going to not just outright say no and you're going to consider the request, you should probably Google something first. There's this wonderful parent's guide on IMDb that gives you all the gritty details of what's in a movie. Maybe even, I think they probably have it for video games now as well. Those are all things parents can do before putting a video game in the hands of their kids, in the same way that they would do that before they send their kid to a movie or something like that. So yeah, discernment and intentionality, that's what I would say to Christian parents.
So now I want to talk specifically about the newest release of Assassin's Creed. Can you tell us about Assassin's Creed? Because it is one of those older titles, a little OG there. And what's kind of an overview of this particular series? What's the setting and what are you doing in the game?
Yeah, so Assassin's Creed is now a long-running video game franchise created by Ubisoft. French developer. And when I was a kid, I remember getting a PlayStation 3, which came out, I think, toward the end of 2006. And when I got my console, probably 2007, there were two video games that came with it. The first was the original Uncharted, which remains one of my all-time favorite video game franchises. The other was Assassin's Creed, the original Assassin's Creed. And I have been a faithful player of those two series since quite literally their inception. I've played all of the Uncharted games, and I've played all of at least the mainline Assassin's Creed titles. And Assassin's Creed has become one of the most successful, to use the word franchises in gaming history. And at its core, the series blends historical fiction, which was always the selling point for me, with science fiction. And it frames this in some pretty interesting ways. The central conceit was framed around the actual historical group known as the Assassins, which emerged in the Middle East in the medieval era. So the original conflict in the first Assassin's Creed video game was between these Assassins, the quote-unquote good guys, and the Knights Templar, the quote-unquote bad guys. And the lore of the series was then sort of built around that. And it has since, some would say it has since changed drastically. The truth is it's probably just evolved, because those sort of medieval categories would have to expand as you begin to move to different parts of history. But you basically have a series in which each title has the player, that's you, reliving historical events through this futuristic device called an Animus, which allows players to access the genetic memories of their ancestors. That's the sort of the central conceit of the whole thing. The way that you enter into these historical settings is you're essentially going through someone's genetic memory. And each game is sort of set in a different historical period. We've run the gamut from ancient Greece to the Italian Renaissance to the American Revolution to most recently feudal Japan. And the games are known for their very detailed historical settings, this sort of very futuristic mythological framework. It has a stealth gameplay where you play an assassin, and very sort of kinetic help to popularize what they call the parkour style movement. That's typically how your character traverses the settings. And these sort of very complex narratives that deal with philosophical and political themes, so on and so forth. So that's sort of Assassin's Creed, just in a nutshell.
So one of the things about video games is there are a certain kind of entertainment, but there's also a sense, I think, for video games. You know, we've talked a lot in this podcast about different fandoms out there, as we've covered, for example, Star Wars, or even you talked about The Last of Us, which has a new season right now on HBO. But, you know, Christians also are pulled in by this sense of not just entertainment, but fandom. Like, I really like this setting, or I really like these characters and I want to go experience it. Should they be aware of anything before playing these games and entering into them? Because I would say certain kinds of entertainment from other parts of the world, specifically Japan, I would say, and this is nothing on, you know, being critical of Japanese culture as someone, I'm Asian myself, but I'm just saying that it is very much permeated with a particular worldview that's uniquely Eastern, I would say. Mm-hmm. And so is this something, as, you know, more and more Western, not just Westerners, people all over the world have kind of a fascination with a lot of Japanese fandom and entertainment. Is there something they should be aware of if they're entering into a game? Like you said, this is a French publisher, but it is set in a Eastern setting.
Yeah. So short answer, yes. And to unpack that, I remember when the very first one came out, there was this little blurb that comes up on the screen as the game is coming on that basically says, you know, this is a work of historical fiction that was put together by people of different religions, different worldviews, different this, that, the other. And I remember the first time I saw that, I thought, oh, that feels like a warning. I feel like it's basically saying, look, whatever shots we take at anyone in this story, understand that it's, you know, we don't have an axe to grind. And it turns out that kind of is exactly why that is there, because the game reinterprets and reimagines real world religions, and to use the word worldviews, through a lens of science fiction and historical revisionism. So here's sort of what that means in detail. At the heart of the series, and this is sort of leans into the sci-fi aspect of it, and I should preface this by saying there's a debate, a great debate among Assassin's Creed fans about how important this stuff is to the games that you're playing. Some people would be completely content, and I probably fall in this category, of simply being turned loose in a historical setting with none of this stuff there. It just doesn't matter to us. Other people really love it. But at the heart of the series is this fictional ancient race called Isu. This advanced humanoid species that predates humanity, basically ancient aliens. And in Assassin's Creed lore, they created humanity as a servant race. And many of our religious figures, myths, and the miracles in human history are reinterpreted as human misunderstandings of Isu technology or influence. So these artifacts in the games that are referred to as Apples of Eden, so you can already see, you know, how it would offend certain Bible readers, are these powerful Isu devices capable of sort of manipulating human will. And these are said to have inspired religious relics like the Holy Grail, the Ark of the Covenant, even like the concept of original sin. So Jesus and these other religious figures in the lore are religious prophets who wielded Isu artifacts, making their miracles really just the result of science rather than divine power. And while the games do not, deal in a outright dismissive sense with the concept of God, the franchise really sort of heavily implies that whatever we consider divine or miraculous is really just, you know, some kind of misunderstood ancient science. So to be fair and paint with a broad brush, these themes are not just metaphorical. They're explicit lore points. And the games suggest that faith, miracles, divine intervention, all of these ideas are just misinterpreted phenomena rooted in the manipulation of early humans by a technologically superior race. So not just for Christians, but I would say for anyone of religious conviction, this raises a major concern, particularly around how divine revelation and like human dignity are portrayed. So that little disclaimer that comes up at the start of every game, that this is a series that is made by a people of, you know, from all different walks and of life and stripes and religions and beliefs and that kind of a thing, is there to sort of cushion the blow that we're probably about to, in some way, shape, form, or fashion, offend everyone with the story that we're about to tell. So I would say, yes, while the video games themselves do sort of portray the convictions, the religious beliefs, that sort of things that were part of the cultures in which they're set and the times in which they're set, from the 30,000 foot lore standpoint, all of that stuff is just people deceived. And the quote unquote real story of history is what the assassins and these Templars, or what is now being called the Hidden Ones, is the assassins' old name, and this order of the ancients. What they're fighting over is the control of these artifacts. The assassins are much more about liberation and free will, and it's sort of a Matrix idea, right? This, we have to free their minds. We have to, you know, help people. We can't let them, you know, live in this darkness and be manipulated. Whereas the Order of the Ancients or the Templars are all about using these artifacts to manipulate people and keep them under control and not let them know the truth and so on and so forth.
We invite you to explore our website, equip.org. And you know, the Christian Research Journal has been around in a print and online incarnation for almost 50 years now. And so there are thousands of articles there, just all kinds of things that can equip you as a Christian as you think about Christian apologetics, Christian ethics, and how to answer the latest pop culture phenomenon, like the one that we're talking about today with the video game Assassin's Creed. And also, of course, we've got evangelism tips and hermeneutics articles, our philosopher's series. There's so much there to explore, really, from many decades of our publishing. And so you will find so many thought-provoking articles there, as well as where we upload all these podcasts for the Postmodern Realities. I hope you're subscribing to it at your favorite podcast feed, but also the Christian Research Journal Reads. You know, we are heading towards 100 episodes in the next month or so of the Christian Research Journal Reads. And all that is audio versions of all these articles. And so if you like to listen to podcasts as you make your commute or you work out, you can hear the full text of these articles, some of our most popular ones. So please explore our new podcast, The Christian Research Journal Reads. And also, as always, I will ask you to partner with us. Please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, because most people, as I mentioned before, listen to podcasts either Spotify and Apple. And Apple's where most of those online reviews are aggregated. That helps us out with the algorithm, which only means that your help in just putting a short review in helps us to be discovered by other people looking for this content. And the more people that discover us and get the word out, the better it is for us as we continue to bring you everything for free without a paywall on equip.org. Now, back to my conversation with Cole Burgett about the video game Assassin's Creed. Well, this particular new entry into this the series of Assassin's Creed is called Assassin's Creed Shadows, and it's, I want to ask you a little bit later about some of the controversy around it, but it's, you know, had a pretty successful launch in terms of how many people are playing it and the sales. But you kind of gave us an overview of the series, but what is this particular installment about, and how does it fit into the canon of Assassin's Creed?
Yeah, so Shadows is the latest, what we would call, mainline entry in the series. So there have been lots and lots of little Assassin's Creed spinoffs and things like that, mobile games and handheld device games and things like that. But the mainline entries are the major console releases that have very long development cycles and are, you know, pretty big games. And this one is set in feudal Japan during the late Sengoku period. So we're talking 1500s. And this is a setting that, what's interesting is I'm old enough now to remember as a kid thinking this would be like the coolest thing if it was set in Japan with ninjas and that sort of a thing. And it turns out I wasn't the only person who thought so, because this is perhaps the most requested setting for Assassin's Creed since its inception. And it simply took what I would say is way too long for them to get there. And it features two protagonists that you can sort of switch between playing as. The first is a completely fictional character named Naoe. Naoe is a female shinobi, or just a ninja, for lack of a better word, who is part of the Assassin Brotherhood, the Hidden Ones, as they were called. The other character that you play as is sort of interesting, and you mentioned the controversy, and this is ultimately where that goes. The character is Yasuke. Yasuke is a legitimate historical figure. It's the first time in the series history, I'm pretty certain, that you actually get to play as a historical figure and not a fictional character. And this historical figure, Yasuke, was an African man who became a samurai under sort of the legendary warlord Oda Nobunaga. And the game, of course, blends these different historical events from that period and these historical figures like Oda Nobunaga with the series' ongoing lore. It maintains those traditional themes of control versus freedom, but it places them within the Japanese cultural and historical context. And so Shadows continues the Assassin's Creed tradition of exploring things like historical identity and occupation and the consequence of power, but it integrates this into Japan's religious and philosophical backdrop. And that's pretty much what Shadows is.
So, you know, we just touched on, I mentioned that there was some controversy, but it was quite highly publicized. In other words, before it's released, there was some very highly publicized controversy that kind of touched all the way over to Japan itself. Could you explain some of the elements of the controversy in a nutshell? Because there were some different things happening at the same time before it came out. And of course, you know, there's a lot of subreddit threads on this controversy.
Yeah. So the controversy has, I would say, several talking points. And we'll start with one and sort of try to give an overview of this. So
it's not just one controversy.
It's not just one controversy. And there is a sort of a broader narrative here. And I suppose I should probably just couch the broader narrative in this way. It is sort of no big secret that Ubisoft has lost a lot of good faith with gamers in the past few years. And this is reflected in sales. So the other major release for them, the most recent major release for them was Star Wars Outlaws. They actually did a Star Wars video game that did not sell well at all. It was not extremely well received when it premiered, when they were showing trailers for it. and not as many people as they would have liked were maybe even needed to justify the cost of making the game, bought the game. And so the narrative, at least, is that the company sort of went on its heels at that point because they had a bit of a history of putting out very mediocre games with these huge development cycles and lots of money being thrown at them, only for people to not really like them. And they've sort of flirted with different controversies for a while. Everything from, you know, what people can buy in-game, the cost of video games. There's a sort of a broader cultural discussion around video games that Ubisoft is sort of like the easiest one to throw a rock at. But there are some Shadows-specific controversies that erupted. And one wonders if these would have come about had the company not already been taking flack. So the first and perhaps the most well-known of the controversies centers on the inclusion of Yasuke as a playable protagonist. Now, while Yasuke was a documented historical figure, some critics claim that featuring him as a main character in a game set in feudal Japan was historically inaccurate or an instance of forced diversity. So despite the fact that there are historians who confirm Yasuke's actual presence in Nobunaga's court and his story being, you know, fairly well documented in Japanese records, there are people who feel that, gamers who feel that this is not only mildly offensive to Japan, they finally get their Assassin's Creed game and you don't let them play as a Japanese guy. That's sort of how they are approaching this. But supporters of the decision argue that his inclusion is not only accurate, but offers a sort of unique and fresh and underrepresented perspective in gaming. And so the debate about Yasuke in particular reveals these broader cultural tensions around just representation in video games in general, which is, you know, it makes sense that that debate would be happening now because it's dealing with historical interpretation and it's especially dealing with identity politics in media. And that sort of debate really doesn't bother me. Now, personally, I have played the game. I feel that his inclusion is actually really well handled. It is not as though the game, and this is where I think maybe some of the fear of certain gamers was, is that this game is going to drop you into the middle of Japan as this, you know, very tall, very large African guy who, even though he's historical, you're just supposed to roll with the fact that this is not weird, that, you know, that this dude is just sort of taken as almost like a, we're just going to sort of understand that he's Japanese. And that is not the case at all. The whole opening of the video game is about how he gets to Japan with the Portuguese, how Nobunaga takes an interest in him. And so I would say that the concerns are...
And those are historical facts, right?
Yes, yes, yes. And I would say that the game itself, it makes their concerns part of the narrative. And I would say it this way. In a different world, the way the game actually deals with him is kind of racist, which makes sense given the time period. He walks in and heads turn. And for many of these characters in the game, they have simply never encountered a black man before. And so the subject of his skin is just a major topic of conversation between some of these characters who do sort of see him as an outsider. And so his narrative arc in the game, his character arc, if you will, is this sort of struggle with belonging, of not being from Japan, of being sort of forced to Japan as a slave, and then having gotten there, having sort of by happenstance fallen in with this great warlord and sort of rising through the ranks, almost stumbling through it, if you will, stumbling upward, if you will, to the point where, you know, he becomes this sort of samurai who has to fight for and earn the respect of the Japanese people. And so I would say that the concerns of playing as the character are understandable. You know, people have clamored for a game in feudal Japan for years, and this is what you're given. but the story is handled quite well, and it should quell the concern in that regard. But that being said, that's not the only controversy. The other major controversy I've seen, and this starts to get into why the Japanese government has now had to comment on this game, which is kind of crazy that we live in a world where this stuff happens. But the controversy happened again in the midst of all this discussion where people are like, you're disrespecting Japanese culture, blah, blah, blah. They always release like merchandise with these games, little statues and figures and things like that. And one of the statues that was issued very early on seems pretty innocuous. And it's the two characters, Yasuke and Naoe, the shinobi and the samurai. And they're sort of posed on their little statue near a half torii gate. And if you don't know what a torii gate is, you've probably seen one in a movie about Japan. It's the usually the red tinted, brown tinted gates, if you will, the sort of open gate with no door on it. Those are called torii gates, and we can talk about their importance later. But the torii gate that was shown on the statue bears this really sort of striking resemblance to the one-legged torii standing outside one of the shrines that is a remnant to the 45 nuclear attack on Nagasaki, half of which remained intact and upright despite being located less than it's less than a mile from the center of the blast. And so that broken torii gate has come to take on a very serious historical and cultural significance for the Japanese people. And, you know, they put out this statue where the characters are just sort of like hanging off of this gate. And so people sort of went nuts about this design. It's like, do you not understand what that image of the gate represents? And so, you know, there had to be we're not going to create this statue, we're sorry for causing offense, we're going to go redesign it. And it was almost like it sort of turned comical, to be honest, because it's like the company just could not catch a break. It seemed like every time they turned around with this game, they were offending someone. And the most recent controversy was that now that the game is out, you could walk into like shrines or temples and break things. And given that Japan has seen an uptick in, let's say, bad tourist behavior, there was a major concern on the behalf of the Japanese government that this game would sort of, to go back to that discussion of do video games lead to other things, would sort of encourage this violence, would encourage this disrespecting of Japanese cultural heritage and destroying things in temples and things like that. And so like the day the game launched, the company had to release a patch, which, you know, players download and it fixes little bugs and glitches in the game where you can no longer destroy things in these temples. So this game has quite literally courted controversy since its inception. And it is almost comical the degree to which every time they show something new, within like 3 days, an apology has to follow soon after, which fuels the debate and the controversy.
So that's just a lot to think through. And you just talked about it even caused the Japanese government to have to respond. And you said that people have been wanting this Japanese setting for some time. So it is set in Japan, kind of like the ninja vibe, and it deals with other parts of traditional Japanese culture, including their religion, which is one type of Buddhism that is practiced there, is Shintoism. So could you give a little general overview of that? Because we talked earlier in this podcast about people encountering non-Christian worldviews that are really essential to some things that are happening in some forms of entertainment, whether you're watching anime or, in this case, playing a video game.
Yeah, so Shinto is sort of interesting. So we mentioned the torii gate. So to connect this for people, a torii is this Japanese gate structure that is usually situated at the entrance of a Shinto shrine or inside of a Shinto shrine. And the idea of the torii is that it begins to mark the transition. It's a thing that is placed to mark the transition from the normal world, from the everyday world, into a sacred space. If you're thinking in terms of Christian equivalent, it's kind of like walking through the doors of a church, is the way that some people would think about that. And if you can't readily conjure an image of one, just look one up. I'm sure most people have probably seen one. There's the really famous torii from Itsukushima Shrine, which is the one that's sort of half submerged in the water, if you will. And they're actually, if I'm not mistaken, they're now marked on Google Maps in Japan. There are these little icons that show you where the torii are. And it's very tied in with Shinto or Shintoism. Shinto is the indigenous system of spiritual belief of Japan. And it sort of is often, you and I've talked about this before, it's Eastern religions and Eastern belief systems all sort of get molded together in this amorphous blob of stuff. And the truth is the way that they were sort of distinct originally and then came together helps especially us understand Christian missions to the area, because eventually Christianity comes in and starts interacting with all of this stuff. And so it does sort of help us to know a little bit about it. But Shinto is an animistic or polytheistic belief system that is centered on kami. Now, the kami are spiritual beings or forces that are connected with the natural elements, ancestors, or these sacred spaces, like where the torii represent. And maybe I think the hardest thing for the Western mind to do, especially the Western Christian who is trying to understand this from maybe an apologetic standpoint, is to begin to wrap their minds around what the kami actually are, because they are not, in fact, gods in the Western sense of the word. They are not gods in even the ancient Near Eastern sense of the word that we would talk about when referencing Elohim or something like that. They are seen as the simplest way I've come to be able to describe it is a divine presence. A divine presence in nature, in people, in objects. So this is the weird sort of hybrid animistic polytheistic belief here. Shrines are places of worship and ritual purification. Ritual purification is quite key to Shinto. There are, you know, places in these shrines to purify oneself, water, that kind of a thing. And ritual purity is very important to them for the interaction with the divine. And there are these different festivals, rituals, that kind of a thing that you see celebrating the kami and their blessings in Japan. So it, in terms of religious significance, it's pretty much what you'd expect from a religious system. But the way that they talk about, the way that Shinto frames spirituality is pretty distinct from Western church tradition, is pretty distinct even from, in some sense, ancient Near Eastern tradition, which, you know, if you're a student of the Bible, by default, you're getting into ancient Near Eastern stuff. So Shintoism in Japan, and here is where some of the, I think, the overlap comes in and where people just sort of throw their hands up and go, I don't see the difference. Shintoism actually coexists now with Buddhism in Japan. Buddhism, though, and this is really worth pointing out, Buddhism did not originate in Japan. Shintoism seems to have originated in Japan, but Buddhism did not. Even though today, Shintoism and Buddhism sort of coexist, and many Japanese people practice both traditions without conflict, which is very interesting. And that has a lot to do with the fact that Shinto is less about doctrine. You'll notice that in my little short overview of that, I didn't really get into quote-unquote beliefs or doctrines or creeds or anything like that. It's because they don't really have them. They have Shinto priests, but it's less about doctrine and is more about ritual. It's more about tradition, and it's more about, in some sense, harmony with nature. That's why the Japanese, if you're ever watching a movie or something like that, and you get into those, you know, spiritual scenes, it tends to be greatly tied with nature, those lingering shots of the cherry blossoms and that kind of a thing. because that's very key to Japanese spirituality. It's very tethered and earthy and grounded in the natural world.
So that, you know, you kind of were giving some thoughts about differentiating some things. It raised, you know, raises some questions about Eastern religions. And I think people in the West or Christians in the West don't realize the nuances there. So can you help us go over some of those religions? You mentioned that Buddhism didn't start in Japan, but there's Buddhism, there's Hinduism, and also it's a little bit older. We did a series on Buddhism back in the 1990s, but I want to tell our listeners the actual beliefs of Buddhism hasn't changed since the 1990s. So some of these articles are very relevant in terms of what different kinds of Buddhism there is out there, because it's not kind of a one size fits all. There's very different kinds of Tibetan Buddhism is not the same thing as Theravada Buddhism, or is not the same thing as Nichiren Shoshu Buddhism, for example. So why don't you give our listeners some just differentiations and a little bit of overview of Eastern religions?
Sure. I think you're absolutely right, by the way, that in the Eastern religions tend to be grouped together in Western discourse, especially in Western Christian discourse. I mean, I took at Moody and the schools that I attended, I mean, you obviously have to have some missions classes and things like that. I don't know that I ever heard anyone give a very good and thorough overview of Eastern religions and their origins and their core beliefs and that kind of a thing, just to help me categorize some of these sort of things. So this was all stuff that I had to kind of go off and learn on my own, but has proven helpful, honestly, in some sense. It's some of the most helpful stuff I've got now in the tool belt for talking with people. So we'll start with, because we were talking about it, Shintoism. Shintoism's origin was Japan. I'll try to do this in, let's say, four tiers. The religion, the origin, the core beliefs, and then its particular view of the divine. That's how I'll try to do this. So Japan, for Shintoism or Shinto, core beliefs, animism, veneration of kami, ritual purity. How does the inheritor of Shinto view the divine? There are many kami, so it's polytheistic in a sense, though again, that the kami are not going to be gods in the Western sense. They're simply divine presences. And there are often spirits of nature and ancestors that are talked about. So simplest way to say it, animistic polytheistic Shintoism, general overview. Buddhism. Buddhism is obviously one of the more well-known systems of belief. Buddhism actually originated in India. It has ties to, of course, China and eventually Japan, but its origins is in India, in fact. The core beliefs of Buddhism: life is suffering, and the goal, of course, is enlightenment and liberation. So whenever you see the Buddhist monk, you know, going through the motions, if you will, or meditating or that kind of thing, the goal is to reach some kind of enlightenment. I actually spent a little bit of time with some well-respected Shaolin people, the monks, you know, the Kung Fu people, and learned, had some interesting conversations with them and learned a good bit from them. Going through their routine is actually one of the hardest things I've ever done, because that is something. But life is suffering is sort of their belief. The goal, of course, is enlightenment. It's all about, you know, training the mind, in a sense, freeing the mind. And, you know, when you don't have too much cluttered up there, it's actually quite amazing the stuff you can remember and recall and go through and train your body to do. The view of the divine that the Buddhists have, it's generally non-theistic or agnostic. They're not so much concerned with accessing a quote-unquote God as they are enlightening oneself. Some Western apologists will say, so in a sense, Buddhism is about becoming your own God. Yes, though I have never met a Buddhist who uses that language, is how I will say that. I can see how someone would color it as that, but the Buddhists that I know, the monks that I know, have never used that language to talk about what it is that they're doing. But we have had some interesting conversations. We're very different in how we see things. Connected to that and tangential to that is Hinduism, because I often hear these grouped together, right? We'll say, well, Hinduism and Buddhism. Well, right, but those are two distinct things with two distinct words. Hinduism, like Buddhism, has its origins in India. The core beliefs of Hinduism revolve around the Dharma, or what is called duty, the duty one has. It is tied to call it a doctrine. Doctrines like karma, goes around, comes around, good energy, bad energy. You actually hear this stuff trickle into the mainstream, even without the religious significance attached to it. You know, kids, I feel like even the kids in the Christian high school were talking about one's vibe or one's energy or, you know, that kind of a thing. Hinduism, cycles of rebirth is another major key to them, reincarnation. And there are many deities in Hinduism, polytheistic, very polytheistic view of the divine. And of course, Brahman is sort of the ultimate reality. So Hinduism is, of the ones we've talked about, Shinto, Buddhism, Hinduism is maybe the most recognizable in terms of, okay, so they have gods, many gods, and different beliefs. But then you start to throw in the stuff that has that uniquely, I guess what a Western thinker would probably call that uniquely Eastern flair, karma, reincarnation, those ideas. So that's pretty much Hinduism. Now, the systems of belief that I often find people have absolutely no clue about are actually the ones that originate in China. And that's because Buddhism and Hinduism tend to be, at least in my experience, what people think the Chinese belief systems are. And on one hand, Buddhism has reached its fingers into many, many Eastern cultures and even Western culture to a large degree. And I think that is probably because it's quite amorphous, Buddhism is. It's less rigidly structured than some of the others, which is why it can sort of coexist alongside, even just culturally, with some of these other belief systems. But China has a couple of very distinct ways of thinking or beliefs that predate the Buddhist influx into the country. And one of those is Taoism, harmony with the Tao, which is a term that even C.S. Lewis would borrow to talk about certain things. Core beliefs, harmony with the Tao, this simplicity, harmony with nature, living an uncluttered life. The idea of having things in a very set and specific order is sort of key in this. You'll sometimes hear, you know, the idea of, you know, feng shui, right? This balance, this harmony, that sort of idea. Very principalized. As far as gods are concerned, it's quite pantheistic, Taoism, at least in my estimation. Pantheism, of course, is the idea that the universe and nature are identical to God. So there's these very impersonal, let's call them divine principles that Taoism is about, and being in harmony with nature, which is often confused as Hinduism or even Buddhism, right, is this sort of a very default setting of Taoism. And so you can see how something like a Buddhism can come in and exist comfortably alongside that, since Buddhism is all about enlightenment and liberation, and Taoism is very much about you know, living in balance, in harmony with nature and those types of things. So they're good bed buddies, in other words. And then the other one from China, this is the last one I'll talk about because, you know, who really cares all that much, is Confucianism. Confucianism originated in China and is very much about social harmony. So you can see the sort of the native Chinese religions are about, you know, balance, harmony in one's life. Social harmony, ethics. Ethics is a big part of Confucianism, and it's why I think some people would even say, well, Confucianism is not even so much as a belief system as it is, you know, just a view or something like that. But ethics is a big part of Confucianism. Filial piety, that is a major virtue of Confucianism. It is considered a cornerstone of Confucianism. And it, as a result, it's a fundamental value in many East Asian cultures. And that is respect, obedience, care for one's parents and elders, filial piety. Great emphasis put on the family and even one's ancestors, that kind of a thing. So those are all some of the major components of Confucianism. Education is also really big in Confucianism. And sort of the thing that's always said about Confucianism is that it's not actually a religious system. It's more like principles for living one's life. It's more of a philosophy than anything else, and is quite, I would say, to the degree that it is religious, it is agnostic. It is a sort of a fundamentally agnostic sort of thing. And again, that points to why it can sort of live comfortably side by side with something like a Buddhism or something like a Hinduism or something like a Shintoism, because there's not a strict set of doctrines set down or belief in a supreme deity. And so those types of things live alongside of each other, and ultimately is probably why some of this, those principles and those ideas transmute so easily and so well into Western culture, which is, has been very thoroughly Christianized. Even though we've sort of come through secularism, we still have borrowed some of these concepts and brought them in. So while these traditions I just listed, Shintoism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, they share practices like meditation or ancestral reverence, they actually differ quite dramatically in their views of the self, in their views of the divine, in their views of what salvation is, in their views of the nature of reality even. So even though they're, again, they sort of make good bed buddies, which is why I think it sort of all bleeds together in the mind of the Western thinker, they are quite distinct. And understanding these distinctions is essential for meaningful cross-cultural dialogue, especially from a Christian apologetic standpoint.
Now, we know, as we've mentioned early in this podcast, and you mentioned you're a teacher in a high school, that a lot of younger children or younger students, maybe 14, are playing these games. And I don't know, do they know, especially Christian students, do they know the nuances of these different religions? So is it, first of all, recommended, would they be, you know, maybe confused to be exposed to this Eastern worldview in a game like Assassin's Creed Shadows? Or do you think, if as parents, if they realize, okay, this is one of the favorite games of my kid, how can we enter into discussions, help our kids know about it so that they could use some of the settings that they find or some of the, you know, world building that they find as a springboard to conversations about the Christian faith?
So one of the coolest features that the Assassin's Creed series implemented a few games ago, and I'm not sure if they've put this out for Shadows yet, I suspect that they will, is they sort of have this mode, which you can turn on, which just drops your avatar into the world, and there's no quote-unquote gameplay. You simply walk around. You can walk around the world that they've created of the game, which is always generally, even if it's not a one-to-one correlation because of size and scale, it's a pretty accurate recreation of historical cities and things like that. And you can walk around as this avatar, and there are all these little, almost like a museum, right? You can walk around and read stuff. That mode, which you can switch on, you can just walk around and basically learn about the culture, learn about what they believed in. It's sort of like a little virtual museum tour of a recreation of, I think Egypt was the first game they did this with, a recreation of ancient Egypt, a recreation of ancient Greece. And you can do that. It's actually kind of an interesting concept. I don't know that they've put this out for Shadows yet, but that is actually a great tool. I have often said if they would ever just make a video game set in ancient Mesopotamia, that is 100%. And they had that feature in there. That is 100% a feature that I would use in teaching. I would, without question, have my kids running around, you know, ancient Babylon in that mode, learning about things, seeing, having the visual representation of things. So I would say that, yeah, there are actually tools that the developers have put in that encourage people to learn about that kind of thing. But it requires intentional engagement rather than just passive consumption. So I do think Shadows or games like Assassin's Creed can be used as a springboard into apologetic discussions. And it can sort of motivate one to learn a little bit more. I have a friend who is sort of like what I would call an ancient Egyptian buff. He doesn't have a degree per se in ancient Egyptian studies, but I would, honest to goodness, put him toe to toe with a person with a PhD in, you know, Egyptology, for just sheer wealth of knowledge and how much he knows. And that a lot of that started with Assassin's Creed. He fell in love with one of the Assassin's Creed games that was set in ancient Egypt. And he can tell you anything and everything that you could ever possibly want to know about the life of Cleopatra and her era in ancient Egypt, because that's when that game is set. So it can sort of encourage people to learn a little bit more, explore that kind of a thing. So thematically, the games raise questions about free will, control, which can obviously parallel theological conversations about God's sovereignty, human agency, human responsibility, human culpability, those kinds of things. So there's sort of an obvious inroad just thematically there. But the historical faiths, right? That's something I think the games have done consistently well. Assassin's Creed explores different historical interpretations of religion. And to me, that's, you know, that's like inviting a critically thinking Christian to engage with how Christianity and other religions are represented, to clarify what is true or what is misrepresented. It sort of invites that kind of thing. And then just, of course, cultural appreciation, right? Learning about Japanese history can foster different kind of conversations, thoughtful conversations with friends from different backgrounds. And I think that the most important thing in that realm of discussion, and this is where I think the Western Christian really needs to do a little better, and to say it that way, is it helps the Christian avoid the caricature. Eastern religions and systems of thought often fall into caricature, which is why it all sort of exists as this amorphous blob in the Western mind, despite the fact that there are clear distinctions, and the history of how Buddhism reaches China and reaches Japan is important. And it, in fact, has a direct effect on what happens when Christianity finally reaches China and Christianity finally reaches Japan, and what the Christians there encountered and the things that they were up against. All of that stuff feeds together. And so it can help the Christian begin to avoid caricatures and speak from both a place of curiosity and a little bit of grace. So at its best, I think, this kind of engagement can help bridge faith and culture. And it enables Christians to, you know, maybe speak a little more thoughtfully and intelligently into the lives of friends who may not otherwise be open to spiritual conversations.
Well, that's a lot of food for thought about video games. But now on a fun note, I want to ask a question for Cole. Cole, you told us you play video games. So what is a video game you could recommend that you are currently playing?
That I'm currently playing? I'm not really currently playing much. I will say this. Last year, because I pushed this game as much as I can, because it didn't sell too well, but it was great. Last year, Ubisoft released a new Prince of Persia video game. If you're an old school gamer, you'll know the name Prince of Persia. There's a new Prince of Persia video game. It's a 2.5D side-scroller called The Lost Crown. It is a thumb-breaker, but it is absolutely fantastic. And so I push people toward that game as much as I can. So Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast. And we're going to look forward to Cole this summer covering some of the big blockbuster movies that have been long-term franchises that we have not covered yet. So thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 443 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Cole Burgett. He has written a video game review for the Christian Research Journal. His review is called Blades, Spirits, and the Sacred, Encountering Shintoism in Assassin's Creed Shadows. You can read this review for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org.
You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Handegraff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out
on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.